Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who frames discussions about race in America, and who influences the way we see ourselves and the assumptions we make about our neighbors? My guest today is a poet, playwright, and social critic who has devoted much of his writing to exploring how blacks are perceived and treated in this country as compared with members of other racial and ethnic groups. He finds striking and distressing differences in many areas and believes at least part of the blame rests with the overwhelmingly negative messages presented about African Americans in the media. Ishmael Reed's most recent book of essays is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. Ishmael, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you.
Who gets to talk about race in the media?
Well, I think it's monopolized by white men, according to studies that have appeared in the New York Times, San Francisco Chronicle, and other places. Recent studies said that 95% of the people who get to have their views aired on the opinion pages are white males, and very few African Americans are invited to the party. And most of those that I've seen on cable lean to the right. So we have the absurd picture, absurd to my mind, of black reporters and correspondents for the Washington Times criticizing Reverend Wright's sermons when the Washington Times is owned by Reverend Sun Moon.
You've been very critical of people that you've labeled as conservative, and some of these would agree that that is, in fact, the label they would have, but people like John McWhorter and Juan Williams and Shelby Steele. Do you see their perspective on being black simply different from yours, or is it wrong?
Well, they're heavily financed by think tanks, and we just don't have the means to get access to the kind of coverage that John McWhorter and the kind of coverage that Juan Williams. There are a few syndicated columnists like Juan Williams and Clarence Page who seem to monopolize all the what little space there is available for African-American views, and they tend to lean toward the right. Now, John McWhorter is sponsored by the Manhattan Institute. I just read an article. Somebody sent me an article from the London Times where McWhorter was holding forth, and they described him as they described the Manhattan Institute as a Republican outfit. It's not a Republican outfit. It's very far right, to my mind. Sponsored Charles Murray's The Bell Curve. And when I debated John McWhorter on Michael Eric Dyson's show, he said that they'd cut ties to Murray, and they sponsored him a few months ago at the Harvard Club to talk about how African Americans have lower IQ ratings than whites. So it's not Republican at all. So with the backing that John McWhorter gets from the Manhattan Institute, he's able to get a great deal of coverage, and it's very difficult for his critics to offer criticism of his point of view.
And McWhorter and others like him, one of your biggest arguments is that what they seem to talk about very often is the problems within the black community.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're restricted to that. They can't. I read an article today. As a matter of fact, today there's an article about the rise of AIDS in the Hispanic community. And I wrote a piece for Counterpunch asking whether some of the critics of African Americans loved Hispanics. They criticized African Americans under the guise of tough love, like presidential candidate Barack Obama did in his Father's Day speech. When he went to the Council of La Raza, he praised their values when Hispanics, the statistics regarding Hispanics are probably more dire than those of African Americans. For example, high school dropout rates, drug addiction, drive-by shootings. So they're very selective toward whom they aim their affection. And I think the reason for that is that you can always gain power or political power and prestige or whatever goals one has in mind by criticizing black people, especially black men.
So do you think that tough love is it more than just a factor of being able to sort of apply that from within one's own community as opposed to the outside?
Well, Barack Obama claims that he's transcends a race. He's a post-race candidate. yet he reserves his harshest criticism for one community. So I think the love should be spread around. For example, according to the New York Times, the average drug addict in California here is a suburban white woman. So why don't those who criticize the values of the African-American community, like George Will, I mean, there's a whole industry. I don't mean to just single him out. Why don't they love suburban white women? Also, there was a statistic that came down citing the increasing incarceration of white women in prison, while that among black women has decreased. Why no love for these women? So I think when we talk about tough love, we should love people of different ethnic communities, not just one.
I'm going to ask you to make a generalization here, and I realize it's that, but talk about the difference between the way we see black Americans in the media in general as opposed to the way we see white Americans portrayed.
Well, we don't get variety. For example, I discussed some of the images that we get on CNN.
You say CNN is one of the worst proponents of racism.
Well, I think it is. I think I've given you a couple examples. A few years ago, every Christmas there's a Christmas present to African Americans. There's always a story about African Americans or black people going out to the bar, getting drunk, and leaving their children home. That's our annual Christmas present from the media. So there was really an outrageous example of irresponsible reporting when a few years ago some black children reported that their parents had abandoned them and there's no food in the house, and so they ate rats. This turned out to be untrue. But I was in, I think it was in the Midwest at a college at the time, and a student from South Africa said her mother called her from South Africa and asked, was this true? So these images go all over the world. In CNN's case, it's 200 countries. Jeff Kanaje, the recent reporter for CNN who covered New Orleans, mm-hmm. he went and exaggerated, you know, the mayhem and the rape. As a matter of fact, there was an urban myth that came out of there, or should I call it a suburban myth? About, you know, a 7-year-old being raped and her throat slashed. This turned out to be untrue. It was David Carr of the New York Times who pointed out that a lot of these stories were exaggerated or simply were false. But there was Jeff Kanaje, their correspondent down there, talking about widespread looting when this was not the case. Finally, he became the one correspondent they had in Africa and got into trouble and had to resign. So he went over there and accused people in Zimbabwe of eating rats, and this turned out to be not true, and staging some kind of rebel activity in Congo. So, I mean, this is the kind of irresponsible reporting we get. Now, and it's very difficult for the media to criticize itself. After Katrina, for example, the government apologized and different institutions apologized or said that they were short and assisting the people in New Orleans. The media went out and spread this propaganda about their widespread looting and all this kind of, and there was no correction. So I hope, you know, they have a media museum or journalism museum, I think, in Washington, D.C. There should be like a hall of shame, which would give examples of all of the riots and the civil disturbances and the lynchings that happened in the 20th century as a result of inflammatory and sensational media.
Do you think, Ishmael, that this is something that happens deliberately? Do you think there's a room in which someone says, okay, we've got stories to tell, and let's put all the negative stuff on black Americans and all the positive stuff on white Americans? Or is it just a sort of a more subtle rendering of the way people view things?
I think it's a marketing decision.
Really?
Yeah, and I think it also helps this taxpayer-subsidized free market system that we have here survive by distracting attention from its excesses and, blaming it on a scapegoat. And this is nothing new in history. If you travel around the world, as I have, when I went to Japan, I asked about the Yakuza, which is the mob, and the Japanese told me that it wasn't Japanese, it was Korean. If you go to Finland, it's the Swedes who are the scapegoats. If you go to Switzerland, it's the Italians. So, I mean, it seems that many cultures have the scapegoat. We just happen to be the scapegoat in this country. And so I think it's probably a marketing decision. It also is something that, you know, promotes the self-esteem of whites by showing that, you know, whatever they are, they're not black. They're not in African-American situation. So I would like to see more cerebral African-Americans on television. I know, for example, that when I look at MSNBC and other cable outfits, I see white authors, especially white male authors, promoting their books all day. You know, from the very morning, from Morning Joe in the morning from MSNBC to Larry, to the Larry King Show. And when you see African-Americans, they're usually perpetrators or criminal suspects or drug addicts. For example, I have criticism in my book of this series called The Wire. And, you know, when I look at The Wire, I find that if you look at The Wire and you're from outer space or somewhere, you think that all the drug problems in this country were located in the African-American community. That's not true. As a matter of fact, Joseph Califano, who should know something because he was a drug czar, says that most people purchase drugs from their friends. So there's an enormous problem of drug addiction in the white community. Matter of fact, we might be known as a nation of junkies, both for illegal drugs and prescription drugs. But here again, it's all blamed on black people.
Ishmael Reed is my guest. He's a poet, essayist, playwright, and social critic. His newest book is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. Do you think, Ishmael, that most white viewers of television are entertained or as you said, sort of comforted by negative images of black Americans?
Well, I haven't done a poll. I haven't seen a poll in which this question is asked, but there seems to be a huge market for it. Otherwise, I don't think the producers and scriptwriters and Hollywood and other sources of entertainment would be pushing this. So there must be a market for it, but I don't know the motives. But I know that in my experience, as a matter of fact, I have an essay that was published in Playboy about how I taught a course at San Jose University. I had a chair down there, the Lurie chair, and the white students were shocked at the idea of white poverty. I was using some of the literature from the 1930s, including Tilly Olson and others, and they just were not aware that this was happening, when it's happening right now. We seem to locate all the poverty in Appalachia, but anybody who thinks it's focused there must travel by air. These people should take the train once in a while or take the Greyhound buses. I did, traveling from Oakland to San Jose when I taught there. You'll find, you know, a lot of poverty. I mean, I traveled from Oakland to Reno, and I saw nothing but cities of trailer parks where whites were living. So it's not just Appalachia. There's widespread poverty. And for some people, the depression never ended. But one way to get around that is to say that poverty is a black problem, and it's caused by, you know, lack of personal responsibility. This is a new argument that you hear from Obama and others, the post-race movement, of which he is the leader, that if people just exercise personal responsibility, all these difficulties in the African-American community would disappear. Well, I happen to be in a family in which I have six half-brothers. All of them are achievers. The brother who lives with me here in Oakland, half-brother, is a pediatrician, and he's personally responsible. I mean, he has a radio show, and you know, that goes to a number of markets. He raised four children, four daughters. He was a widower, but that didn't prevent the AMA from discriminating against black doctors. He's a doctor, so where did his personal responsibility get him? So being personally responsible is not enough. There are still institutions like the banks and the medical profession and other areas of American life that discriminate.
Let me have you pause, Ishmael. We need to take a break. We'll
sure.
be back in just a minute with Ishmael Reed. His new book is called Mixing It Up.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
Good. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ishmael Reed. He's a poet, essayist, playwright, and social critic. His newest book of essays is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Our email address is think@kera.org. It takes us just a little bit off topic, Ishmael, but since you brought it up, you said the AMA discriminates against black doctors. Can you talk about what you meant by that?
Well, no, I mean, there was a report that came out where they apologized mm-hmm. within the last week. Not only is there discrimination against black doctors for which they apologize, but there are disparities in health care. And I think if anybody wants to Google that, they could go to the New England Journal of Medicine, where I got the information about how black patients are treated differently from white patients.
Yeah, there have been a lot of recent studies about that. Do you think that Americans, black, white, brown, or otherwise, always see race first? Or are there people capable of not using race as a sort of shorthand device for making assumptions about other people?
I think that we have a irresponsible educational system. With that in mind, my daughter has written a book that's going to be published in the fall, my youngest daughter. Tennessee, some years ago, I asked her to write about her education because I found that most of the books written about the experience of Hispanic and African-American kids in school are written by well-meaning, middle-aged, middle-class white males. I asked her to write about her experience in school, so the result is a book called Spell Albuquerque, Memoirs of a Difficult Student, which will be published in the fall by A&K Press, and it's worse than I thought it was. I mean, this book is shocking about the attitudes that many teachers have toward black and Latino students. So I think it's probably the educational system and the media, which is where I think most Americans get their information. So they just rely on the stereotypes that they learn in the home, which is sort of like the breeding ground of bigotry. I hate to say that, but that's been my experience. What they get in the newspapers and other places. And with the declining readership, one place we could go to present a different point of view was through books. And now, today, I learned that the Los Angeles Times is folding its book review, and this is happening all over the country. Which is going to lead to rising rates of illiteracy. Matter of fact, I wrote a piece for Playboy entitled Showing White Students Some Love, where I found that, some of the reading abilities of white students are just as bad as those of Hispanics and African Americans. There are low reading levels in states in this country where there are few black and Latino students present. So, for example, in Cleveland, I think it's something like 74% of white students read before their reading level. And also in Maine, which is 95% white, there's fourth graders read before their reading level. You can get all this information from Ed Week, Education Week, which issues an annual report. So I think that's one place where we could go, where we have power. I mean, where Richard Wright and Frederick Douglass and a number of writers, black men and women, were able to go to present a different point of view. And now that's no longer a place where you have power to talk back. As a matter of fact, I just did an anthology that'll be out in January from DeCapo entitled Powwow, where I talk about how writers are able to take on issues that are neglected by the media, points of view that are neglected. For example, we can get Pauline Marshall, in one of her stories called Rena. Pauline Marshall is a distinguished African-American writer, where she talks about the sort of black character that we don't hear about, a young black teenage girl who reads well and widely and an intellectual. This is the kind of person you don't see. We get Lil' Kim in the media. So even there, our opportunities are diminishing to be so. People get most of the information from a school curriculum that lacks diversity.
Well, let me stop you for a second. I think that's an interesting point when you bring up someone like Lil' Kim. Is that image as damaging to the way black people perceive themselves as the way white people perceive black people?
Well, see, here again, African Americans don't make these decisions. I mean, African Americans had little to do with the creation of some of the hip-hop stars.
Many of those stars are African American.
Well, yeah, that's true, but the people who own the companies that produce their CDs are not African Americans. As a matter of fact, most of the recording companies are owned by foreigners now. So you might have somebody in Japan owning a record company that sponsors hip hop music. Hip hop is big business all over the world. I don't know whether the stars are the people who are performing the art are getting as much money as people who own these companies, but they created that. And I noticed that Bob Herbert and my friend Stanley Crouch in the Daily News, New York Times, they write critical articles of hip-hop, yet those newspapers really push it hard. If you look at the Times every day, they have almost a supplement on hip-hop artists because I think they're trying to get a younger demographic or whatever. Suburbanites, who buy this stuff.
Ishmael Reed is my guest. His newest book is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Adam in Arlington. Hi, Adam.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I was wondering if your guest would discuss the interview that Michelle Obama did on Fox News a couple weeks back where they referred to her as Barack's baby mama. And also, what do you think of the Boondocks? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
I didn't see the interview, but I think that's a disparaging term. But that's typical. I mean, I've seen worse than that, not only on Fox News, but some of the other networks and cable stations that are supposed to be liberal. I used to follow Boondocks, but...
It's a comic strip, is that right?
Yeah, but I understand the cartoon has been suspended.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Can you talk about the Barack Obama candidacy and what it's illustrated to you about the way that the media covers race?
Yeah, well, I think though he's getting there's a misconception that he's getting a free ride. I think. He's had to deal with a segregated media. Often they refer to him as Osama bin Laden. That's a number of anchor people and reporters made that mistake.
Well, in the opinion media, they're not. Are you saying that there have been sort of straightforward reporters calling him that?
Yeah. Yeah, it happens very often. As a matter of fact, I saw one report about Osama bin Laden where they put, we had Osama bin Laden's picture on the screen when they meant to have Obama's picture.
I haven't experienced any of those, but that's very disturbing the case.
It happens regularly, but when they say he's getting a free ride, they ran that Reverend Wright thing to death. I mean, he lost points because of his being associated with his preacher. I mean. Yet John McCain didn't get the kind of scrutiny or criticism for his association with evangelists who made controversial remarks like Reverend Falwell and Reverend Pat Robertson and Reverend Agee. Even Mrs. Clinton was associated with Billy Graham, she, as a matter of fact, during the scandal in the White House, she referred to Billy Graham as their spiritual advisor, yet he made outrageous remarks and slanderous remarks about different ethnic groups during the interview with Richard Nixon. So that seems to be unequal, the way the evangelists were regarded, Reverend Wright and the evangelists who associated with the other two candidates. Also, I think the media did help Mrs. Clinton a lot when they showed her... Being tearful after losing Iowa, and they ran that day and night, and then the 3 a.m. in the morning ad where she put out this Willie Horton type ad where no white woman is safe if you like these dark people or the Islamic horde's going to come over here wreak havoc in the country. So I don't know where they get this idea that the media is favorable to Obama. I don't see it.
You write in the book about having written about Bill Clinton and his relationship with the black community long before Toni Morrison was credited with having called him the first black president. Do we have you on the line?
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm wondering if you think that there is something more to being black in America than having black skin.
I think that some people have successfully adopted an African-American style. As a matter of fact, some of them have fooled me. Like, when I was a kid, I thought that Mose Allison, the pianist, was black. So,
does it bother you when people who aren't black adopt a black style?
Well, it's okay if they adopt it as long as they don't claim they invented it or, you know, they originated it, which is what's happening with jazz and blues. I interviewed Ronnie Stewart of the West Coast Blues Society. And he said that in some of the blues festivals now, or in blues festivals now, it's rarely that you see an African-American blues musician performing. So, as long as they don't claim that they invented it or they invented rock and roll, which is the misconception of a lot of people in the younger generation, is that Elvis Presley or Bill Haley and the Comets invented rock and roll. When even the Rolling Stones and the Beatles admitted that they were influenced by black musicians. So I think there's sort of cultural imperialism creeps in when white musicians or white artists take a credit for forms that were invented or created by African American musicians.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Mel in Dallas. Hi, Mel.
Hey, how you doing?
Great, thanks.
Hey, Ishmael. Your name sounds familiar, but I think I've read a book of yours. Did you have a book about out of Africa?
No, I've written a number of novels.
Oh, yeah? Well, anyway, let me get to my point. My question or my comment is, I'm 43 years old, and I see Barack as a progression of the struggle that Dr. King fought for. Now, I do believe that maybe he is being a little tough on the African-American community, but I believe it's tough love, like you said, and I think that he has a point. And I see the guys who are, I think it's a generational thing, where older are gentlemen have a problem with him coming out and saying, pretty much putting out dirty laundry out in public. But I think that if you look at the statistics, now I'm not saying they're all accurate, and I'm not saying that other people don't have negative statistics in their communities, like as an Anglo or an Asian or a Latino, but he's neither one of those. He's running for president of the United States, true enough. But when you go see the NAACP, he's talking about a community that's almost in total decline in certain areas. I think his point was good that he made about fathers not taking care of their children, because it's not a slander, it's a true fact.
Do you think that's peculiarly a African American problem?
No, I don't. But I think that's what he was dealing with at the time. He was at the NAACP's convention.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would like to get the views of the 12 million or so white women who've been left in poverty as a result of divorce. In a country in which two out of three or I don't know the most recent statistics, two out of three marriages end in divorce, and there are all kinds of family arrangements. To say that this is peculiarly an African-American problem is probably not accurate. I've read one statistic where it said a woman's income is reduced by 70% or so when she endures a divorce. And, a number of millions of men don't pay child support. So I think this is another example of, if I may be blunt, white men who sort of like control the media, passing a buck, so to speak, no pun, to African Americans without examining the way they treat women. I read one study that shocked me that came out of, I think it's Lois Weiss, State University in New York. She interviewed white middle-class women. 90% of them said that they had been battered or had seen their...
90% of white middle-class women said
right,
they had been battered.
That's right. They were shocked that or seen their sisters or daughters battered.
I haven't seen the study.
She was shocked because she said this came from middle-class homes. These were middle-class women. So I think that as long as these guys run the media, the way they treat women, there will, I mean, you know, it seems that the white working class Reagan Democrat male is the gold standard for how men treat women. That seems the implication of his speech on Father's Day.
Let me stop you for a second.
Excuse me, that he was trying to appeal to white male Reagan Democrats. I think if you examine the way they treat women, you'll find a lot of alcoholism and battery.
Certainly, Ishmael, there has been, yes, there is alcoholism and battery in every community, sadly. What Mel was calling about, though, was Barack Obama specifically, but he was talking about African Americans, talking about problems within the African American community. And this is something that you also think is detrimental and really shouldn't be, except in the full context of every ethnic and racial group in the country, shouldn't be discussed?
You know, he appeared before. I think people ought to read Adolf Reed's piece about this Father's Day, Sister Soldier moment. Adolf Reed, the sociologist who is a professor, has a piece at the Black Agenda Report, Black Agenda. It's online. It's a lengthy piece with about 100 replies where he talks about how, you know, Barack Obama went before these sort of like right-wing Christian groups where he was cheered and got standing ovations. Those people just don't know the facts. I don't care if 80% of African Americans agree with him. They just, this 80% don't know the facts. I'll give an example. Bob Herbert, one of the few op-ed writers that the New York Times feels won't alienate their white viewers, said that illegitimate rates were skyrocketing. This is contradicted by his own newspaper. This is contradicted by the Centers for Disease and Control and Prevention, which knows more about the facts than Bob Herbert on the opinion page of the New York Times, where they said that there's been a steady decline in illegitimacy. And among African Americans, it's plummeted the most. I mean, I think that report was issued in December. If you go to the New York Times, you'll find it, where there's a steady decline. There's been a little uptick in the last year or so, but generally there's a steady decline in illegitimate births. So where does he get the fact, this stuff about it skyrocketing? I guess that's where Obama got his facts from.
We will be back in just a minute with Ishmael Reed. His latest book is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ishmael Reed. He's a poet, essayist, playwright, and social critic. His newest book is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Just want to come back to something briefly, and I don't want to spend the rest of the hour arguing about this. We have some numbers that say that a study conducted in 2000 by the National Institute of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention said that overall 37% of American women have experienced battering. So I suppose, Ishmael, if the study that you saw also included people who had an acquaintance who had been battered.
They say white women are scared to talk about it.
So in other words, they wouldn't admit it if it had happened.
They said in this study by Lois Weiss that where 60% of black women were very candid, you know, white women are afraid to talk about it. They don't talk about it.
The same study that I see breaks it down according to race and says 21.3% of whites have been battered, 26.3% of African Americans, 21.2% of Hispanics of any race. So it sounds like they're talking about it in equal numbers, but this is a study from 2000.
Well, this study is recent, and it's from State University of New York.
We'll have to take a look at it. Thank you. Yeah. Ishmael Reed is my guest. His new book is called Mixing It Up. Let's speak next to Wayne in Dallas. Hi, Wayne.
How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I listen and look at your show every so often, and I appreciate the opportunity to call in.
Well, welcome. Thank you.
To Ishmael.
Yes, sir.
This one thing I do have to say. The reason why Barack Obama is so popular is because he is a different type of black man in this point. When has America, for the most part, embraced a black man who got raised by his white grandparents after his father left their daughter. Now, sometimes you can say that a white man will look down with favorability on a black female child, but for a white man to take in the black son and look on him and take care of him, that is unique. That's one reason why he is palatable to white people. Jesse Jackson got white people in his family. I got white people in my family. Every black man, every black person in America got white people in his family. But
the difference is, white people took him in. Why do you think that every black person has white family members?
Why do I think that? Because if you are an African American, meaning that your people came from slaves, you got white blood in you.
Why?
There's no way. Because the historical fact is white men raped black women.
Okay.
And some white women did have affairs with black men. Wasn't as recorded as much, but we know it did happen.
Well, I think you're being very modest because you could say that white men use black women as harems. It's all in the literature. It's all testified to by people like William Wells Brown, who was a slave, who was there. If you read New People by Joel Williamson, you'll find that this is widespread. Although from the media and from other reports, we get that this was just Thomas Jefferson and Storm Thurmond were the lone perpetrators. So that's why when I hear reporters and when I read in newspapers that he's biracial, well, most African Americans are biracial.
Ishmael, what do you make of the research that we've seen lately that says that today's teenagers and 20-somethings, this generation, millennial generation, really copes with race and views race in a very different way than any of the previous generations have? They will make friends without thinking much about it across racial and ethnic groups. They will date across racial and ethnic groups. Is that a good sign, do you think?
Well, you know, Elvis Cleaver talks about how the generation of whites in the 1960s could dance very well, but a lot of those people became regentrifiers and moved to the right. So we'll see.
So you don't think it's going to last?
I hope it's true. I certainly have found that, hip-hop has sort of brought, although it's denounced, hip-hop has really brought people of different backgrounds together. And maybe the Pentecostal church. When I look at these Pentecostal programs on television, they're some of the most integrated audiences that I've seen.
And there actually is research to say that people who worship together are the most integrated of any sort of multiracial group.
That's quite possible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Felix in Irving. Hi, Felix.
Good afternoon. I wanted to ask your guest, when Robert Johnson, the founder of Black Entertainment Television, when it was in his hands, one criticism that was directed toward him was some of the programming was, quote-unquote, a little risque. But since he is sold to Viacom, I'd like to ask your guest, how does he feel Black Entertainment Television is now in the hands of Viacom? And I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks, Virgo.
Well, I think it's probably not a hopeful sign. I used to appear on one of their talk shows frequently, but I think that talk show was eliminated. So in the beginning, they were open to worthwhile forums about different issues. But now I think it's probably sort of like MTV from what I hear.
Do you think it's possible for people of really different racial and ethnic backgrounds to understand each other?
I think if you want to understand people from different backgrounds, you should go to their literature instead of to the movies and to television, because I think you can get a point of view that's missing from those other media. For example, I learned a lot about Polish-American life by reading Polish-American authors, even though I went to a high school that was predominantly Polish-American in Buffalo, New York. But I was never invited into a Polish-American home.
So literature is a better window for you than human interaction.
I think that's absolutely true. And you'll find that people from other communities are able to talk about their dirty laundry in fiction. For example, in South Asian culture, if you read Asian Week, for example, it's a very good magazine, find there are a lot of problems that are attributed solely to the African-American community, drug addiction, domestic violence. But in the media, in order to embarrass African-Americans, Asian-Americans, who are all lumped together, 38 culturally distinct groups are used to embarrass African-Americans, so you think that all Asian-Americans are valedictorians.
Do you think that you've said that you feel like intellectual blacks are kept out of the media deliberately? Is someone sort of saying, well, we have a choice here, and let's make sure that we choose someone who is white?
I think intellectuals who sort of sing to the choir or on the same page as some members of the right are invited on. For example, I think Michelle Bernard.
Hello? Yeah, we're having some odd phone issues. Let's see.
Michelle Bernard is on all day on MSNBC.
I'm not sure what's going on, Ishmael. We're going to take an incredibly short break here and try and get you on a separate line. So
hang
with us. We'll call you right back.
Okay.
Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Perhaps we can get some of you on the line and take your comments while we're waiting to fix that telephone issue that we're having with Ishmael. Let's go at this point to Cheryl in Dallas. Hello, Cheryl. Hi, Cheryl. Are you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi. Can you go ahead, please?
I just wanted to make...
Okay, we've lost Cheryl, but we will try another call. Let's see if we can talk to John in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hey, Chris. Am I with you?
You're with me, for now anyway, yeah.
Okay. The two quick comments I wanted to make are a comment and question that maybe you can take forward is, I think Ishmael missed the point of The Wire. The Wire was talking about institutional racism, institutions that keep the black...
Okay, we don't have John either, but he was talking about Ishmael possibly misrepresenting the point of The Wire. I'm not familiar with the show myself, but we may be able to circle back around to that once we get Ishmael on the line with us. Ishmael, are you here?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Okay, well, you sound excellent now, so let's just go back to our conversation. Let's talk for a minute about your mom, because she's also a writer and, in fact, spent 10 years writing her life story.
Right.
what did you learn from her and from her efforts? You were already established as a writer at the time she did this.
Well, she's not the only person in my family who writes. My spouse, Carla Blank, has a book out called Rediscovering America, published by Random House. My oldest daughter has a book called, a novel called Showing Out, published by Thundersmouth Press. And as I mentioned before, my youngest daughter has a book coming out in the fall, and she's got four books of poetry. She published her first book when she was 10. So there's nothing unique in the family. My mother began her memoirs at the age of 74 and completed them when she's 84. And now she's 92, and she's working, or going on 92, and she's working on her new book.
And she asked you not to send her articles when you publish something in Playboy, not to send her one in the mail.
Yeah. She told me not to send her any issue of Playboy. So.
but chronicling her...
I already am curious about her.
Chronicling her story, you write that it also taught you some things about her life that you hadn't known before.
I was not informed or didn't know enough about the bond between Southern blacks and Southern whites, which... In the case of my mother, and I think many others, was sort of like constituted a extended family.
Mm-hmm.
So this book revealed that when members of my family had difficulty, it was the whites who intervened and made things easier for them. For example, my grandmother worked for some very wealthy German family on Signal Mountain in Chattanooga. And when she had a mental problems, they really looked after her, and also my mother, as being a single mother, had difficulty getting housing and projects, and this family intervened. One of her boyfriends was caught in a compromising situation with a white woman, and one of the other employers intervened to get him out of town. And when my mother was injured in a racial incident on a bus, people think that Rosa Parks was the first to resist the segregated policies of the transportation system, but there's a long history of that. And so African Americans often insisted upon being treated equally on buses. So there was a riot, and my mother was injured, and her employer went and got her compensation from the bus company and told the bus company that they would do it for her. So these my mother kept in, my family kept in contact with these Southern whites. They still keep in contact with them. It puzzled me growing up in the North until I read this book.
Is it hard for you to reconcile stories like that with the overwhelming inequality that you see and the treatment in the media and other places that seems to, in your perception, really always work against African Americans?
Yeah, I think that there's less one-on-one. There's less of a one-on-one relationship with between a different groups because of maybe the segregated school system. And my daughter ran for school board, and that was quite educational. And she talks about her experience at the university, and we find that because different groups, Asians, African Americans, and Euro-Americans are kept apart during the grammar school and high school experience, when they come to the university, they're at a loss on how to treat each other. And, you know, some of the most racist opinions about African Americans came from not only the professors, but from Asian Americans and Euro-Americans, because they had no experience of being around African Americans as youngsters. So what we have here in Oakland is what I call latte segregationism. In the sense that, you know, people who were really might be called progressives are the ones who are insisting upon neighborhood schools and are against the well-off schools in the hills and other places accepting African-American and Latino students.
So the biases remain. They're just sort of couched in different terms.
Yes.
Yeah. What would tell you that we're making progress in this country?
Well, I think an example of progress, and I have to give, although I'm critical of Barack Obama, I'm very proud of him. And I think one thing he's accomplished is that up to now, African-American men have been considered evil, and now we're the lesser of two evils. So I think that's great progress.
Well, hopefully more progress is yet to come. Ishmael Reed's most recent book of essays is called Mixing It Up, Taking on the Media Bullies and Other Reflections. Ishmael, it's been a great discussion. Thanks for spending the hour with us.
Oh, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.